Today's date is July 14th, 1997. The speaker is Jim DeLange. The subject is A Home for the Homeless.
I've been a senior pastor for 16 years. Prior to that, I was in an administrative position with one of the predecessor bodies of the ELCA. And prior to that, I served a church in Huntington Beach, California for 14 years, a church which I started. So that was ended up being a large suburban church. And now I serve in the heart of the city. Let's see here. We need to tell you to go ahead and roll the tape.
Roll it.
We'll have time for questions after I'm finished making a presentation here in a few minutes. Throughout the history of the Lutheran Church in this country, why church communities have been formed in one of two ways. First way is where people have defined themselves as part of an ethnic group or by language. And another way is part of that is that they define themselves by family ties or by geography. In this context, where the church has been defined by language or in ethnicity, why the Lutheran Church is but one expression of that community, alongside of many other expressions. But the community already exists. The Lutheran Church is just one expression of that community. We might call these church communities of culture. Many of our Lutheran churches were founded in this way and existed for many years in this context. There were Scandinavian and German churches who took their place right alongside of the Swedish Society, of the Norwegian Club, or the German Bund. And in church hymns, when they were in church, the hymns and the liturgy served as a vehicle to preserve the language and perpetuate the culture. There were potluck dinners with ethnic foods, and there were church auxiliary organizations, which also served this purpose. And these ethnic and linguistic church structures often continued long after the members of the church had been fully integrated into the economic and civic infrastructures of the communities in which they lived, and very often, of course, too, long after these people had learned the English language. Church communities of culture grew steadily in this country, Lutheran churches, until 1920, when there was the first immigration law passed, which restricted immigration into this country. But many of these ethnic and linguistic churches existed for decades after 1920. Now, another part of this is that are church communities that exist based on family relationships, which is another expression of this phenomenon. In this way, congregations which have a lot of family connections, there's a lot of family relationships, ask the church to serve in a way to maintain those family relationships and to keep them alive and to celebrate them. So, for example, baptisms in this context and confirmations are primarily family rituals, and the aspects of the rituals which are spiritually and religiously connected are secondary. Interrelated families often belong to the same churches for generations. And they wouldn't think of leaving these churches, no matter who the pastor may be, or how he or she preaches, or what terrible things they might do, because, you know, that's their family church. These churches grow by marriage, and by having children, and people are pulled in as they marry into these family connections. when these family ties begin to unravel because the younger generation moves to some distant location, or the family matriarch or the family patriarch dies and there is no successor, why the church also declines and sometimes also ends up dying. Our Lutheran churches in San Francisco are classic examples of communities based on ethnicity and language, where church and religious ritual was brought in to serve the various communities of culture. Unlike most of the Lutheran churches in California that were founded after 1930 by people who moved out from the Middle West and from the East in the 1930s and 40s and 50s and 60s and so on, the Lutheran churches in San Francisco were founded by the immigrants who came directly from Europe in the latter part of the 19th century. And at one time, we had over 40 Lutheran churches in San Francisco. Many of them made the transition to English after World War I, but they still maintained their ethnic character. And eventually, they found themselves as ethnic islands in the midst of strangers in an alien kind of culture. Between 1955 and 1970, the Lutheran churches of San Francisco lost half of their membership. Congregations merged, others closed. St. Francis, the congregation which I serve, is a merger in 1964 of a Danish Lutheran church that was founded in 1903 and a Finnish Lutheran church that was founded in 1890. The two churches, which were only 50 yards apart, were declining in membership and merged in order to survive. And really all they did was to hold off the decline for a little longer. When I arrived in 1981, 17 years after the merger, they had about 40 people worshiping in the English language, and they were still holding services in Finnish for four people, twice a month. All of them spoke English. Today we have 10 ELCA churches in San Francisco, two independent Lutheran churches, of which St. Francis is one, it's because we were removed along with First United Lutheran Church, and that's another story I'll cover another night. Of these 10 ELCA churches, one is Spanish-speaking, one is Chinese-speaking, one is German-speaking, and one is primarily African-American. There, with the exception of about three of these 10 churches, most are struggling to survive. And it probably will only be a matter of another 10 years when we'll have even fewer churches. There are probably about, I think as I counted them up, there are six Missouri Synod Lutheran churches in San Francisco. But together, these 18 Lutheran churches in San Francisco have less than 1,500 people a week worshiping. 18 churches, less than 1,500 people out of a population of 750,000. Clearly, Christian communities based on culture, language, and family ties have had an unpromising future for a very long time. The second way that Christian community in the Lutheran Church is formed is when people who define themselves as Christian, or Lutheran Christian specifically, seek out other Lutherans to form a Christian community, or they join an existing community. Now, this has been the pattern for Lutherans and Lutheran church members in America today and has been for many years. As people relocate to new places, they shop for a church, or if their ties to the church back home are very strong because of family ties or because of land or community, they don't seek out a new church, but they still think of the church back home as church, even though they haven't lived there in 30 years. When I served in Southern California for all those years, why there were some studies done, and only about 25% of the Lutherans who came out to came west in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s joined a Lutheran church. Found a church and joined it. Joke was always is that the litter on the other side of the Rockies was made up of letters of transfer that people threw out the window before they came over. Daughter passed. In any case, studies by the Gallup organization indicate that the percentage of Americans that belong to a church hasn't really changed since 1937. It's about 40%. What we're seeing with these so-called mega churches, most of which are located in fast-growing areas, is really a reshuffling of the saints, not any great new Christians, great numbers of new Christians. So what we see are two ways in which Christian community has been formed in the Lutheran Church: by family or language ties, or when people are already Lutheran and seek out a Lutheran community. But there has always been a third group who did not define themselves as members of a Christian community. Perhaps they had a brush with it at one time, but were never part of one. These are the strangers that the Bible speaks about. And the question I would just want to ask is, who are these strangers? And what we want to do is read a few sections from the Bible, and I gave a couple of you some Bible readings, and we're going to do that now. But in this context, as we hear these sections from the Bible, we have to remember that Christianity is not yet, in this context, a distinct religion. It is still a Jewish sect, still considered part of Judaism. And so let's hear the first one, which is Luke chapter 8, 19 through 21, I think you've got there.
Then his mother and his brothers came to him, but they could not reach him because of the crowd. And he was told, "Your mother and your brothers are standing outside wanting to see you." But he said to them, "My mother and my brothers are those who hear the word of God and do it."
Okay. So Jesus redefines in this context who it is his family, if you will. If you read the same passage in Matthew and in Mark, which is the same incident, he said, "Who are my brothers and sisters? Who is my family? Who are my brothers and sisters? These here are my brothers and sisters who follow me." Okay, now we'll hear from the letter to the Ephesians, which is the passage that is the theme of Holden's community this summer. And Diane, you have Ephesians, if you'd read that, please.
"So then, remember that at one time you Gentiles by birth, called the uncircumcision by those who are called the circumcision, a physical circumcision made in the flesh by human hands. Remember that you were at that time without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace. In his flesh he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall, that is, the hostility between us. He has abolished the law with its commandments and ordinances, that he might create in himself one new humanity in place of the two, thus making peace, and might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility through it. So he came and proclaimed peace to you who were far off, and peace to those who were near. For through him both of us have access in one spirit to the Father, so that you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are citizens with the saints and also members of the household of God, built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself as the cornerstone. In him the whole structure is joined together and grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are built together spiritually into a dwelling place for God."
Okay, thank you. And the section from 1 Peter, Jack, if you'd read that.
but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you, as aliens and exiles, to abstain from the desires of the flesh that wage war against the soul. Conduct yourselves honorably among the Gentiles, so that though they may malign you as evildoers, they may see your honorable deeds and glorify God when he comes to judge.
Okay. The Greek word that is used for aliens is a word called paroikoi. It comes from the word for oikos, from oikos, which is the word for household or home. These were people that you might call resident aliens. It's probably the best way to refer to them. They were literally, if you would, were without nationality and so on. There are two groups of strangers or aliens living under the conditions really of social and religious alienation. And they were, if you will, people seeking a home, if you will, for a homeless. There were those who were made strangers by the Jewish community. They were Jews who were made strangers by the Jewish community because they could not practice Judaism. They were too far away from Jerusalem. They could not go to observe the temple sacrifices or any of those things. They couldn't afford to travel there. Like you see the people at Pentecost who came from all over and were able to be there, or at the time of the Passover when the city was very crowded when Jesus was crucified. These were people who could not make that trip and never had and never lived in Jerusalem. There were people who did not have a synagogue, or if they had one, they did not have a rabbi. So these were people who were, if you will, were not as familiar with the Jewish ritual and did not practice it so much, and were alienated by the Jewish community. The second group were those who were always strangers to the Jewish community, and they were sort of lumped together in the New Testament just by the word the Gentiles, and that was the word that was used. I'd like to read a section from this book, which is called A Home for the Homeless. It's a study of First Peter, and it's by Jack Elliott, who is a friend of mine, longstanding, and is a professor of religious studies at the University of San Francisco, which is a Jesuit institution, but he maintains his Lutheran identity very clearly. And this is what he says here. He says, the stranger or the alien, in a general way, these terms applied to persons who were differentiated from the natives among whom they lived in respect to their land of origin, ethnic or familial roots, their different views and opinions, and their language, property, and religion. And in general, there, furthermore, such distinctions inevitably involve political, legal, economic, and social restrictions and disadvantages for those so identified as strangers and foreigners. More often, however, the paroikos was viewed as a member of a distinct legal social class within the general native population. Included among the paroikoi were slaves, serfs, and those constituting the multitude of the de classe, and homeless strangers who lacked citizenship either in their previous homeland or where they currently resided. Although the cities had their share of such paroikoi, the far greater number were found among the rural populace of tenants, farmers, slaves, and local artisans. They constituted the working class of the Roman Empire, the class which under the direction of the city bourgeoisie produced the goods required by the cities and by their imperial army, which were the chief consumers. Excluded from voting and landholding privileges, as well as from the chief civic offices and honors, they enjoyed only limited legal protection, were restricted in regard to intermarriage and the transfer of property, could be pressed into military service, were free to engage in cultic rites, but were excluded from priestly offices, and yet shared full responsibility with the citizenry for all financial burdens such as tribute, taxes, and production quotas. Although in everyday life there was little apparent difference between the Paroikoi and full citizens in times of political turmoil or economic adversity, these outsiders were the first targets and scapegoats of social suspicion, censure, and animosity. So these are the people to whom 1 Peter is addressing. All were Paroikoi seeking an oikos, strangers and aliens seeking a home, the homeless seeking a home. And it is to this group that the early church turned its attention. In his study, Some Economics and Social Conditions Affecting the Expansion of Christianity, Samuel Dickey writes about the appeal of Christianity to these homeless people seeking a home. And I'll just read a little section of that to you here, which is interesting. During the first three centuries, that's right.
It's the right book.
During the first three centuries, the general economic status of the laboring classes went from bad to worse. There was no permanent alleviation, and there seemed no hope of it by ordinary processes. Therefore, when Christianity entered with its promises of a new age of righteousness inaugurated by divine power, which included feeding the hungry with good things and exalting those of low degree, it could not help but get a hearing. Well, I think our generation of the church ought to ask itself, who are the strangers and aliens among us? Who are these homeless who are seeking a home? I think that number one, there are those who are made strangers by the church, just as there were Jews who were made of no account by their Jewish compatriots. There are individuals in our society who have torn up the social contract with family and community. This social contract that says that you should go to college, get a job, get married to a good Christian boy or good Christian girl, and have a family. And these folks have decided to tear up that contract and to do something else, to work just enough to get by, and to live with a boy or a girl, and not to have children. There are those who are made strangers by the church because of divorce. They may have gotten involved in an affair and resulted in the family being broken up, and the church more or less cutting them off, if not in reality, but not technically, but in reality they have done that. People still do get shunned in this day and age. Another group of aliens and strangers are women who have had their consciousness raised by the feminist movement and feel alienated in the church because of the exclusively male gender assigned to God. God is always he. God is all. Jesus is always he. The Holy Spirit is always he. The Son of God. Our Father in heaven. All of these male gender type language and the patriarchal concepts of God and the way that the whole church is seems to be run by male pastors, and you never see a woman preach and so on, like it's in churches that won't even consider calling a woman pastor. Then there are persons of color who come from congregations where they were perhaps in the majority. They were of the majority of colored people of color, and they've joined a white congregation, a mostly white congregation, and do not feel fully accepted. Or they are racially mixed couples. I know the church that I grew up in, which is a very large church outside in the suburb of St. Paul, Minnesota, has several interracial couples. And these folks drive by many Lutheran churches to come there because they're accepted and they feel very much a part of things, and their kids can go to the school and so on. Then there are gay, lesbian, and bisexual people who in many cases were, as young people growing up in their congregations, taught Sunday school, were leaders of the youth group, were involved in every way, and then they find out that they are gay or lesbian, and the message is very clear that they cannot be part of the church, and they drop out. The visions and expectations document that we have clergy or for seminary students who are hoping to become pastors is a way of trying to enforce gay and lesbian people to conform to the model of heterosexual marriage. Now you note that all of these people who are aliens and strangers, made aliens and strangers by the church, have been made strangers and aliens not for any theological reasons, but for sociological ones. They did not conform to the unwritten expectations of their church community. And then most often, they're around issues having to do with with who a person is having sex with, or something like that. Gay and lesbian issues are only one part of that. There are plenty of people who are alienated from the church because they have not conformed to the social mores of the community. Meanwhile, the church doesn't want to talk about sex, and every time that it does, there's just absolute chaos. The example is that when we had a draft of the ELCA sexuality statement a few years ago, there were 20,000, and it was released while there were 20,000 phone calls into Chicago within a few hours, all in an uproar. Now, nothing would have that kind of a response. I'm sure the floods in North Dakota, which destroyed a lot of people's lives, did not get that kind of a response. They did not get 20,000 phone calls in a few minutes saying from Lutheran people, what shall we do to help these folks out? So we will have to have silence for the preservation of the church that still exists, and we will say nothing to these strangers. So Lutheran churches will continue to make more strangers out of the members of their own church family. Now there are strangers who are made strangers from their spiritual home simply because of their life journey. There are people who have moved from the places where they belonged and had an identity and find themselves as strangers in a new land. For example, you've got a single college students who moved to a city for their first career type job. And I think of my wife's daughter, Adrian, who after graduating from college in Davis, which is up near Sacramento, moved to San Francisco to be by her mom, but also to participate in the adventure of the city. Well, all of a sudden, for the first time in her whole life, she had no community of reference. She had to make a whole new circle of friends, and that was typical of a lot of people who move into cities. Think of families who relocate. I've always, in the course of my ministry in Southern California, always admired military families, because military families knew that they were going to be moving, and every time that they moved, they found a church to connect with almost as soon as they moved in. They started looking for a church and said, this is where we want to go, and immediately jumped in like they were going to be there forever, even though they knew they were only going to be there maybe 2 or 3 years. But there are families who move and move frequently, and what they do is they often retreat into the microscopic world of their nuclear families, which they carry around the country like lawn furniture, and then they set it up, you know, set it up wherever it is, and maybe get to know their neighbors a little bit, and that's it. Then there are older people who have retired and pulled up their roots and moved to a new place, maybe because it's a warmer climate, maybe because they want to cash in the equity on their house and buy a less expensive place, and all of a sudden they find themselves as strangers and aliens in a new land with no community to belong to. The community that they took for granted and the circle of friends that they had and the church they had and all that for many years back in Detroit or Minnesota or wherever it was, you know, all of a sudden is gone or is out of contact. And when they go back and visit, they find out that people have gotten on with their lives and they just haven't stayed in place. Then there are the oldest of the old, which we find in our city increasingly, where you have people who have lived in San Francisco either all their lives or that they were people who came out during the war and stayed after they retired and have simply outlived their circle of friends. And now here they are in their 80s having to make new friends. And most often what these people who find themselves now as strangers and aliens do is that they isolate themselves even further and eventually die, I think, a premature death. One of the programs in our congregation is to reach out to this group of older people, and for many years we have had an outreach program to older senior citizens and try to keep them connected to a program, which is Jack, our friend back here, a member of our church, cooks for a couple of months out, about 6 months out of the year. Right. He alternates with another person, and that has been a valuable thing, I think, for them. Well, the second group of strangers and resident aliens to whom the church community is called to reach out are those who are made strangers by the United States Constitution and the economic culture of corporate America. Here we find ourselves in a similar situation to the early church. And before I get into my diatribe against not against the American Constitution as an American, but for because of its impact on the churches. Let me read something to you from this book. The propagation of the notion of a new universal father or fatherland to which all subjects of the Roman Empire belonged, and the declaration of the emperor as Father of Fathers figures significantly in the legitimation of the consolidating efforts of the Caesars, their monopolization of authority, and the subordination of their multinational subjects. Under the United States Constitution, people have the freedom to believe whatever they want to believe in this country. That's a right which our founding fathers fought for and died for, and if we know anything at all about European history, we can understand why. And I think that that's still a foundational part of our whole American system. But the religious doctrine of America is that religion is a personal, private thing, and we should leave people alone and let them decide for themselves what it is they want to believe. Now, this is the religious doctrine of America. And when people say that to me, I want to ask them, where did you get that idea? It's not because you came out of the womb with that notion. Somebody had to convert you to that idea. And everyone who lives in this country is told by the government and by the print and television media, by the educational establishment, that if you're going to live in this society and at peace with your fellow citizens, you have to be converted to this ideology. If you have a religion that makes any claims about being more right than Caesar, like Christianity, you have violated the Pax Americana and are branded a heretic. There are millions of people who have never had a spiritual home and are yearning for one, but they won't consider the church because to believe in something as specific as Jesus Christ makes you, well, it means that you are signing up with the ideological outcasts, because that's who Christians are considered in this culture. When given the opportunity, I asked people, I said, if you don't want to be converted to Christianity, what do you want to be converted to? As Bob Dylan says, everybody serves somebody. How odd it is, I think, that Americans who have had little exposure to the Bible or to church think that they are able to make a judgment about Christianity knowing so little about it. As if you get Christianity by living in America, breathing the air and drinking the water and going to public schools. There's a young woman that's attending our church who was raised by parents who loved her and supported her throughout her whole educational journey, but were absolutely opposed to her going to any kind of a church. She is now on a quest for a spiritual home. And I told her what we had to offer her was a spiritual home. It was very much like being adopted by a family. To enter it, we would tell her about Jesus, we would teach her some church jargon, and we would throw some water on her and then clean her up and ask her to sign up for the kingdom of God. After that, she wouldn't be any different than the rest of us adoptees who are in this family, all of whom are trying to live out community, what it means to be living under the rule of God and not under the rule of the predominant culture. Well, tears welled up in her eyes when she asked if she could be baptized. See, the Enlightenment and modernity told Americans that they were freed from the old story, but it never offered a new one. It told us that we could believe whatever we wanted to, and that believing that we could believe whatever we wanted to, we would be happy. But it's not true. And this young woman's displacement and her longing for a home has made her a victim of that lie. And I submit that her company is in the millions. The other group made strangers are those who are made strangers by the American economic structure. President Clinton has a mantra that he repeats in nearly every speech. America must compete in a global economy. What that conjures up in the minds of most Americans as who are workers, both blue-collar workers and white-collar workers, is the picture of busy Asians in Japan and China and Singapore working 14-hour days, 6 and 7 days a week for low wages, selling goods and services cheaper than Americans and undercutting American jobs. The president's message is clear to people who hear his message in this country. If we're going to win, we have to work harder. Corporate America, large and small, responds to this call for a devotion to grow the economy from America's high priest. Corporate America also knows that getting and training workers who will produce is no longer a matter of firing those who don't and hiring new ones who do. Armed with sociological studies and human resource consultants, corporate America knows the deepest needs of their employees better than the churches know about their members. Employees don't just want a paycheck, not even a good paycheck. They want to feel they belong and are appreciated. They want to feel a part of a community. So we hear CEOs telling their employees something like this: "We are a family here at Sieg Heil Technologies. We work together as a team. We care about each other and our families." So they're not just company picnics once a year or a company Christmas party. There are TGIF parties at 4 p.m. every Friday. There's casual dress on Friday. There are great company vacations. There's flex time and profit sharing and 401ks and so on and so on. The goal is to wean you away from all other loyalties except that which you have to the company. Sort of like the old mining and steel towns without the grit and the smoke. Now, does the church have an alternative to these ersatz communities whose bottom line is profit? I would hope so. I would hope we who have signed up for the rule of God would make sure of two things. A, that the spiritual homes that we offer are Christian communities that are unapologetically Christian, grounded in the worship of God and in the Word and sacraments. And secondly, that our communities are welcoming of the stranger and the dispossessed, who are respected just for being human beings and not having to be anything more. I'd like to conclude here with another quote from A Home for the Homeless. And this is a little longer, but I think it is very good. In his essay, The Homecomer, the social theorist Alfred Schultz has reflected on the profound depth and evocative power of the reality called home. Home leaving, homelessness, and homecoming from time immemorial have shaped the dramatic substance of man's story and his history. Odysseus is the archetype of every man. House and home have figured so centrally in the human experience, and its recapitulations because they recall not simply a place or a time, but a state and a condition of being. Geographically, home means a certain spot on the surface of the earth. Where I happen to be is my abode. Where I intend to stay is my residence. Where I come from and whither I want to return is my home. With house and home are linked the existential issues of identity and belonging, personal and collective origin and destiny. Considering 1 Peter, for example, in its own time and place, we must marvel at the ingenious and sensitive manner in which the Christian gospel has been formulated to meet the predicament of social alienation and estrangement. By focusing on the bipolar experience and symbols of isolation and community, homelessness and home, its authors have not only challenged their own community to be a hope-giving and life-sustaining fellowship amid a world of strangers, they have also given to Christian history a profound concept of religious community and a potent symbol socially, psychologically, and religiously for integrating the expressions of hope and the experiences of life. Okay, we've got some time for questions.
Is that we can believe what we wish. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't see how this is so destructive.
I don't think it is destructive for a religious society to be able to live together and get along. In fact, it is the only way it can. It's the only way that we can function. What we need to recognize is that that the very thing that enables us to function as a society in peace also, if it also then becomes the religion, the civic religion, if you will, of the populace, that then becomes a substitute religion to Christianity.
Oh, I see.
And it's contrary to Christianity, which says that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I think that what I would like it a lot better if we say, look, this is what we have to do in America in order for us to live together in peace, as does every nation that has a multi-religious culture. But this is a very pragmatic arrangement. It's not a religion. It's not a religious belief.
When you said the Lutheran Church in San Francisco is decreasing in numbers, is that what is the situation with the fundamentalist churches then, the Baptists and Methodists? I've read where they're growing in numbers and whether.
Well, not in San Francisco. I mean, I mean 70% of the people in San Francisco and north of San Francisco and south of San Francisco aren't churched at all.
Okay.
Over 70%. But you won't find fundamentalist churches growing. Our Lutheran churches are holding their own, but fundamentalist churches really don't get much of anywhere in San Francisco. Yeah. They do among some of the immigrant populations, the new immigrants, Chinese and Hispanic, yeah.
Oh, yes. The topic is mainly about aliens and strangers. I know recently the Presbyterian Church amended their documents so that a gay or lesbian person could not be ordained, and that created vast numbers of aliens. Is this a sort of a trend in the whole church community?
Yes. Every major denomination is struggling with the issue of dealing with gay, lesbian, and bisexual issues, and the question of always comes around ordination, and whether you're talking about Methodists or Presbyterians or Lutherans or have you, they kind of have the same thing as the military does: don't ask, don't tell. Mm. In other words, what the denominations really want gay and lesbian people to do is just not say anything.
Well, they're shooting themselves in the foot.
Exactly. And we really have a couple of large Presbyterian churches in San Francisco, one of which is a very very prominent church, and they're having a terrible time because of the decision of the presbyteries around this. Because you see, it's not only prohibiting the ordination of pastors, but also elders and deacons,
well, sure,
in other words, lay offices as well.
They have to be ordained too.
Pardon?
They have to be ordained
yes,
too.
Yes, that's right. In the Presbyterian church, so we have, people who are lay people. I don't know. I know you're a Presbyterian. Are you ordained as a deacon or?
Well, as a matter of fact, I am. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Well, if I get your thesis, it's coming out of the Levitical widows, orphans, and strangers at the gate, that you were a stranger in the land of Egypt, and I led you out and took care of you, therefore you should do that, and that's your charge. Okay? That's your undermining thesis. Reconcile that, then, with your prohibition of homosexual practices, which were, in fact, a Baal worship type situation, that are also your Levitical. So which one are you going to honor?
No, I didn't. I'm not saying this is coming out of a Levitical code. I'm saying this is coming out of a New Testament code.
Well, yeah, but that's based on what he's saying, is you were a stranger in a strange land yourself.
Well, he uses that for the exile in Egypt. But
right.
he talks about.
But it's the Jewish background of what it is.
What they're talking. Well, that's a reference. But for people who weren't Jewish, that didn't mean anything. That didn't resonate anything. And the early church, and the early church very quickly was made up primarily of Gentiles, people without Jewish roots.
But still, Paul is coming from that basic tenet too, that, well, besides grace, which trumps everything, but you are charged to take care of community. That's what he was building.
Yeah, who is the community? Who is the community in which you are to reach?
The people,
for example, in 1 Peter, which is the thesis of this book, is that the people who were the people who were he was trying to support were the people who were alienated from the structures of society, some of whom were Jewish, but most of whom were Gentiles.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that the alien, you know, by any identity, is still supposed to be drawn into your community, but they also have to adhere to the communal rules.
Well, but they weren't circumcised.
But Paul says you don't have to be.
Right. He said they don't have to be.
But
signing up for the kingdom of God was a commitment of faith. Period.
Correct.
It's a commitment of faith that the kingdom of God is here. There wasn't anything else. And there were no other conditions.
That's correct.
Yeah, you had a question.
I was going to say, how would Paul have handled that, though, you know, some of these folks, you know, being in the community, if they were homosexual? You know, Paul's response to advice to the early churches, what would that be?
Well, his advice to the early churches were that people not marry, that they'd be like he was.
If you felt that way, though. He didn't say, if you have to, he said you could.
No, that was still his advice. That was his advice, you know, that was his advice, right?
Letters,
you're not married, huh?
Letters though didn't reflect that. I think Paul really thought Christ was coming back very, very soon.
The impression you get is that they all thought that. Mm-hmm. that was the expectation, that Christ was going to come very, very soon within their lifetime.
Jim, what would you say about these programs? We have an Assembly of God program in north of Seattle, you know, that brag about his successes of welcoming, you know, the homosexual, the bisexual, and then into a ministry of getting them to change that identity. What has been your experience with that? I've seen people who appear, quote, you know, to have changed their affiliation, and also when we still have psychiatric hospital in Everett, some people that wound up in there as a result of it too.
But what my experience has been, it's been extremely destructive. It's behavioral conditioning, and the techniques that are used, and they're based upon psychological understandings of homosexuality that were done in studies that were done in the 1950s that have been discredited 20 years ago. And I found the horror stories, you want to hear horror stories of people who, of parents who found out that their children were gay, and these kids were still under 18, and put them in mental hospitals and did all kinds of things. And out of ignorance, sometimes, sometimes out of fear, my experience has been
hospital.
Pardon me?
It's an active ministry. It's not a hospital.
I know the things that are, you know, things that are being done. But underlying it is a belief that says that homosexuality is not acceptable. It is not an acceptable sexual orientation. Everyone must be heterosexual. I mean, that's what underlies it. And once you adopt that belief, then anything after that is a reinforcement of that, to reinforce that belief, including hospitalization. whatever it takes. Council, yeah.
I just really want to second what you're saying. I'm Catholic, and I'm from a congregation in the Twin Cities that is, it just sort of stays underwater most of the time because it disagrees with most of what the church teaches about women and gays and lesbians and the whole thing. So we welcome everybody, and it's just a terrifically interesting place to be. And what we find is, so each Sunday before the Mass begins, somebody in the congregation welcomes everybody else, and they tell their story. And their story is invariably the story that you're talking about. I was this way in my congregation, and I got divorced, and they told me I couldn't give communion anymore. And so I felt shunned and alienated. And not until I found this congregation that welcomes divorced people and has a divorced group, or not until I found this congregation that welcomes gay and lesbian people, did I feel at home again in the church. And there's a terrific need for that. And yeah. our congregation has just flourished because of it.
Well, that is why ours has too. I will say that I think that there is, I think that there is something else that I didn't mention here, and that is that what our, because of the way our American economic structure is set up, is that we don't have integrated communities anymore, except in cities, because of the fact that home developments are built based on economic class and ability to pay and so on, like this, and handle the mortgage payments. And we have so many gated communities and so many self-contained communities. I remember a brother in law once said to me, he says, who was moving to this community in Denver, he says, you know, Jimmy, he says, the great thing about this is, he says, it's built in such a way, he says, so that you never have to leave. They've got stores there, they've got schools and churches there. You never have to leave. You can live in this, you know, little enclave, this ghetto, really, of folks just like us. And that's the way, that's the trend that this country is going to, where in small town America and in big city America, you had people of all classes living near to each other and having to bump up against each other all the time. And that's why in many cases, that's why, for example, the black-white issue in this country, the South has made more progress than some of our northern cities, because their African Americans and white Americans live side by side and knew each other's families and everything else. And in the North, we've isolated ourselves for decades.
Or in Washington, we built 6-foot cedar fences. They're almost required. We don't allow.
Yes, that's right.